KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I'm not saying people were expecting it to be sh**, but, you know, it was just that guy from Twitter and me who hadn't made a show for a while, and like, why would that work?
Irish writer and actress Sharon Horgan and American comedian Rob Delaney met on Twitter. Then they teamed up to create the British sitcom Catastrophe. Their expectations were low, but now Amazon has brought their series back for a second season. And actor Cliff Curtis is a Maori New Zealander who's played a wide range of ethnicities, Latino, Middle Eastern, African American. Now he stars in two projects where he plays characters who are Maori. But first on the news banter, the best-laid succession plans of Mice and Men go awry at Disney. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Disney really surprised Hollywood and the broader business community this week when Tom Staggs, who was the COO and the announced heir who was supposed to take over from CEO Bob Iger when he retires, which was supposed to happen in 2018, suddenly Tom Staggs is gone from the company. Deep mystery about what really happened. Disney's very mum. It's a rare misstep, though. Bob Iger likes everything to be smooth and very buttoned down, and Tom Staggs seemed to be very smooth and buttoned down. And so people are just kind of gobsmacked after a big public grooming and rise through the company. Suddenly this guy is no longer in the picture, and the question of succession is thrown into total uncertainty.
That's the big mystery here, is if this guy was good enough to be the stated heir a year ago, what happened in the year since? I mean, we have heard everything from the board lost confidence in him, or certain board members weren't willing to give him the absolute, yes, you are getting this. We've heard that there were some issues with him being upset that people weren't treating him as an equal to Iger already, that people were just going to Iger and not including him. We've heard everything from Iger now wants to stay. You know, he got a really big setback with this NFL deal. He was part of a proposal that would have brought an NFL team to LA, or two teams actually, and he was going to have an opportunity to buy into as an owner one of those teams. That proposal was bypassed in favor of a rival proposal, and that was seen as one of his big exit strategies, things that he would do after he left. So perhaps he just wants to stay along and be CEO a little bit longer.
That certainly seems to be where the betting is. Just is unusual for Disney to bobble something this important this publicly. Turning to another corporate drama, Viacom, there was a move by Sumner Redstone. He is the ailing 92-year-old founder of Viacom. This is a media empire that includes not just Viacom, which is Paramount and MTV and Comedy Central and a lot of properties, as well as CBS, which is a separate company. So Sumner Redstone, old, ailing. As we've talked about before, he threw his longtime companion, Manuela Hertzer, out of the house. She went to court saying that he was no longer competent to be running Viacom and CBS, that she had been supplanted as his healthcare proxy by the CEO, Philippe Domon of Viacom, and that the whole thing was just a conspiracy, a covering up that Sumner Redstone is basically in terrible shape and a ghost living in his own house, and other people meanwhile are running this company while Sumner Redstone was getting paid millions for this job. This whole entangled litigation seems to be settled now. Manuela Hertzer getting paid a pile of dough basically to go away, and Philippe Domon, the head of Viacom, being removed as the healthcare proxy for Sumner Redstone.
This is a pretty dramatic turn of events considering Sherry Redstone, Sumner's daughter, has had a very tumultuous relationship with him as recently as a few years ago. They weren't even speaking, and now she is going to be in as his healthcare proxy if he's unable to make decisions for himself. This is a big deal because Philippe Domon is widely seen as vulnerable if and when Sumner Redstone is out of the picture and the trust takes over. So now Sherry Redstone seems to be asserting herself even more in the company and in the life of her father. That could set up some corporate drama down the line.
Yeah, the trust being this National Amusements, which is a holding company basically for Viacom and CBS. And upon Sumner's death or possibly declaration of incompetence, that trust will take over. It is believed by many observers that Sherry Redstone controls it. She is not a fan of Philippe Domon. Meanwhile, Philippe Domon has announced that he wants to sell at least a piece of Paramount, considered a crown jewel of Viacom. I think Sherry Redstone would probably really like to block that. So we could be looking at this one terribly embarrassing and public fight with Manuela Hertzer, the companion, finally resolved. And now moving on to the next phase, there's going to be a corporate battle over the fate and future of Viacom. Let me move to Warner Brothers. Batman versus Superman, you know, we talked about before, Matt, it was the movie that was supposed to show that Warner Brothers was on track after a terrible 18 months with a lot of bombs. And, you know, it opened huge. And then, wow, that second weekend was a debacle.
Well, it was a 69% drop-off, which, don't get me wrong, Batman vs. Superman is still making a ton of money and will probably get to $800, $900 million worldwide. But the question is that enough? Is that what Warner Brothers had expected? Is that what is enough to consider this a successful relaunch of a franchise that is going to last probably 10, 15 years?
They have
movies already dated into the 2020s. And for the two marquee superheroes to be in a film and not get to $1 billion, I think would be significant.
Yeah, I mean, you have to factor in how much this movie cost to make and market. And the answer is a really lot of money. So that if that big number you cited, $800, $900 million, does happen, that may mean they'll break even barely or make a little bit of money, but you don't make Batman versus Superman sucking up all the resources of a studio. This is supposed to float a lot of boats, not just break even or, you know, walk away with a little bit. So, you know, when you compare it with some of these other comic book movies or, you know, other franchise idea movies, this number is pretty pale, as you say, with these two big stars, Batman and Superman, two of the most iconic characters in the comic book world.
And what's most troubling to Warner Brothers, and you had an interesting story in the Hollywood Reporter this week, is how surprised they were by the bad reviews for the film and some of the fan backlash to the film. That, to me, is more troubling for the future of the series because it suggests that they didn't really know how to do this right. And you get away with having Batman versus Superman in a title, but are viewers going to come back for additional movies? And Zack Snyder, who directed Batman v Superman, is coming back for two Justice League movies. So they are very much in bed with this whole creative team. And at least from a creative perspective, if you believe the critics and if you believe the audiences, it didn't quite work.
Yeah, and they're the ones that count. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
I call it the Red Line. It's very King of the Jungle, Hakuna Matata, all that.
What good is it if you leave us here to be slaughtered? Huh? I need to find an Americano who I can trust. One with honor, intelligence.
That's Cliff Curtis playing, respectively, an African-American drug dealer in Bringing Out the Dead, an Iraqi rebel in Three Kings, and Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar in Blow. In reality, Curtis is Maori, as in the Maori who are the indigenous Polynesian people of New Zealand. After decades of playing terrorists and gang members, Curtis is at last finding more complex and nuanced roles. Recently, he even played Jesus in Sony's movie Risen. And now there are two leading man projects where he gets to play his own ethnicity. In the AMC drama Fear the Walking Dead, he appears as a Maori American high school teacher. And in the new biopic The Dark Horse, he portrays the late Maori speed chess champion and teacher, Genesis Potini, who triumphed despite extreme bouts of bipolar disorder.
My name is Genesis Potini, my special powers, yes. Yes. I'm going to lead you all to the National Chess Championships up in Auckland in 6 weeks' time.
When Curtis sat down with KCRW's Matt Holzman, he said he's seen opportunities for non-white actors in Hollywood get a lot better.
You know, it wasn't always this way. Trust me, there were some really tough moments where I'd been cast, the writer, the director, the producer, everybody had signed off on me. The deal had been done, the lawyers had done the contracts up, and then the studio execs were like, nah,
really?
Not for us. But they would never say why. And you know, my representation was saying, that's not cool. And they believed it was because of my ethnicity. But over the years, we've gotten over that hump now, and I'm taking roles that are sort of written as like leading man, white guy roles, and
right.
They're throwing it my way, which is wonderful. And it's mainly happened through television, those opportunities.
And that's what they say, that television definitely is leading film in terms of its acceptance. Now, we're here to talk about your new film, Dark Horse, which was about New Zealanders and filmed in New Zealand. And so when you go home and you're in a movie and you don't have to put on an accent, you can just be you, do you feel a little bit of relief?
I do. When I go home, it is comforting. Even now, as I talk to you on this microphone and stuff, you know, I've adjusted my accent. I don't really talk like me anymore because, you know, people would find it hard to understand my diction. But I love going home. I love the vernacular. I love the rhythms and tones and the melodic nature of the way that we speak. And it is very grounding. And I've not found anywhere apart from home that I feel more comfortable.
Well, in this movie, that's interesting because you are playing a New Zealander and you're playing a Maori, but somebody who has a very complicated background, Genesis Potini, who had problems with mental illness but was also a teacher and taught many kids how to play chess. How did you get ready to do that? I mean, he was a big hulking man. I mean, looking at you now and seeing the character that I saw in the movie, they are really two very different people.
Yeah, he's a different human being. He's not me.
Yeah.
And when I heard about the role and the possibility of playing the role, I couldn't see me in the role. Just absolutely honestly, I didn't think it was a really good first choice to cast me in that role. I just thought the physicality, you know, the mental illness is a very, very challenging role, and it was very intimidating for me. I thought, I don't know whether I can really honestly do the role justice. But I read the script and I met the director, who's a very smart, talented guy, and I saw this documentary of this guy, and he was like a living work of art. And it was suddenly the role went from being challenging to impossible.
Right.
And when it became impossible, I just suddenly got a shot of excitement that I thought, I have to do this now. This has never happened in my career. It's probably never going to happen again to get such an impossibly difficult role for me to succeed in, you know, and to honor. You know, once I got that, it was full throttle from there. It was amazing.
You never met him because he passed away a couple of years ago, but had you heard of him before you saw the documentary?
No, I heard about him through this film. And that's the beauty of this film, is that it is about an unsung hero that without this film, I never would have heard of him. He lived within the small subculture of a tiny town in New Zealand, not far from where I'm from, and I'd never heard of him. And for me, it's an incredible privilege, and it's kind of the point of the film,
right,
that we can use cinema and storytelling to celebrate these individuals in our community.
So how did you physically transform yourself?
Yeah, I went to work at it.
Did you eat?
I ate. My daughter actually helped me with the weight gaining regime, and she said, sumo wrestlers eat lots and lots of food, and then they go to sleep. So that's what I did.
Right.
But it got nauseating. I got really sick. I got headaches. I felt like nauseous a lot, but it was just my body chemistry trying to figure out what was going on.
He was a beer drinker, too. Did you drink beer?
Well, what happened is I couldn't keep the weight on, as that much weight on. I put on a lot of weight pretty easily, you know, being middle-aged and all, but there was a certain point where my body was sort of fighting it, And I couldn't keep eating that much food. It made me feel sick. And then he was a beer drinker. I was like, yay, lots of calories in beer. I was, chugging back about a dozen to two dozen beers a day.
Oh, man.
Yeah, here's a tip. Beer and chess go very well together. And I'm not really a big drinker or anything, not usually. Occasionally I have a bit of fun, but the challenge of enjoyment of chess playing certainly became more as I was drinking beer.
Did you play chess before you started?
No.
Did you pick it up for the movie?
I'm obsessed with it. It's been a few years now, and I've tried to stop playing chess, and I just can't. It's like I play probably an hour to 2 hours a day online.
Still drinking the beer while you play?
Not the beer. Okay. The beer had to stop.
Let's talk about the film business in New Zealand. I mean, for Americans, when we think of New Zealand, we often think—
Hobbits.
We think of Hobbits because they were filmed there, obviously, which is not a bad thing.
We love Hobbits.
Yeah.
It's so cute.
Right, exactly. And they bring in a lot of money.
Yes, that too.
What is the film scene like there?
It's very vibrant. It's very strong. And we're really grateful for what Lord of the Rings and Peter Jackson and his, and now Jim Cameron's moving to New Zealand. He's making Avatar there.
But the movies by and for and about New Zealanders.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, though, what they did is they built infrastructure and they built up a world-class crew and support teams and producers and all of that and raised the level of consciousness to sort of think, we can do anything we want. Then the next big step is that we didn't lose our focus on telling our own unique stories. I think it's very, very important. For a small nation such as ours, a few million people, we fight way above our weight. We deliver some pretty significant stories and films. And what can I say? I've been very, very fortunate to be involved in a number of those films and produced some of them. In a small nation, when we look out at the world, if we didn't have stories about ourselves, we wouldn't know who we are because all of our content would be coming from overseas, from the UK, from the US. There'd be nothing on the radio or on television or in the cinemas that reflect who we are.
Yeah.
So thankfully, we've managed to continue to invest in those stories about ourselves. But here's the fascinating thing, is that when we get it right, it's not even about us anymore.
Right.
It just sort of elevates to this whole other level where it's really stories that reach humanity. And those little films like The Dark Horse, we've won awards as far-flung as Ireland, Asia Pacific, San Diego, Seattle. It's been an amazing trip.
So you play Travis Manoa in Fear the Walking Dead.
Yes.
And that is a character who is consistent with your actual roots in terms of his biography. Yeah. Was it written that way?
No, he wasn't written that way at all. They cast me in the role, and then they said, hey, would you be open to sort of him being your own ethnic background? I was like, hell yeah. Yeah, I'm down with that. The last name is Manoa. Manoa means heart. And so he's kind of like the good guy of the piece. He always comes from his heart. So that became his last name.
Has there been anything in the show that you've brought from kind of your background and your culture that you've kind of inserted, small or large, anything?
Yes, there is.
Like
my sister wove this belt.
That's on screen?
And that's Travis Manoa's belt, And it's sort of like a little thing. It's very rarely sort of seen on the show, but it's something that I carry with me. Here's the funny thing. Because we're talking about ethnicity and stereotypes and all that kind of stuff. And I did work for many years. I played drug dealers and gangsters and all of those stereotypes of what ethnic roles were given to, doled out, for a long time. Many, many people of color have had to work their way through those stereotypes to elevate their careers, So it's like earning your stripes. But I got to say, this last year has been amazing because I went from Genesis, right, back home, this little indie film, to then play Jesus, which when I was a kid, Jesus looked pretty white to me. I never thought I'd be cast as Jesus. And then I went to Manoa, which means heart. And so all of a sudden I was being offered these roles, central roles to movies, and I was asked to bring love and hope and inspiration and do characters that want to help others. And that's been an amazing turnaround for me in terms of my career and that as an ethnic person and coming from an extreme minority on the planet, I feel so privileged and honored and grateful that I've been given those opportunities right here in Hollywood. It's amazing to me.
Well, congratulations on the film and on a really fascinating, really interesting career. And thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Cliff Curtis is the star of The Dark Horse.
Coming up after a short break, two writer-actors, Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney, on how a connection on Twitter led to the creation of their own TV show, the British sitcom Catastrophe. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. American comedian Rob Delaney and Irish writer and actress Sharon Horgan created and star in the British sitcom Catastrophe. In the show, they play Rob and Sharon, an American man and Irish woman who meet in a bar while Rob's on a business trip to London. They have what both expect to be the briefest of flings. But when Sharon finds out she's pregnant, Rob returns to the UK, initially just to help her through the pregnancy. Of course, it doesn't end there. Charming and profane, Catastrophe drew raves on UK's Channel 4, which co-produced it with Amazon Studios. Now in its second season, Catastrophe jumps ahead with Rob and Sharon, now parents, still trying to navigate their relationship.
It's not healthy the way that you are with her now. You know what you remind me of? The way that you hold her, the way that you gaze at her? Gollum. From Lord of the Rings, Andy Smeagol, the weird CGI man thing.
Yeah, I know who Gollum is.
Good, because that's what I see when I look at you now.
Because?
Because of the way you're all hunched over her, like, don't touch my precious. Stay away from my precious.
Well, you know, I thought you were comparing me to Gollum because of my sunken eyes, so now I don't even care.
In reality, Delaney really did move his wife and kids to London to work on the show. When Horgan and Delaney were back in the U.S. briefly, they spoke to the business contributor Michael Schneider and explained that despite their surprise success with season one, there was still some serious anxiety about season two.
I thought, well, you do that once and then you can't do it again. And so we really put ourselves to task to make the second season as good or better, we hope.
Yeah.
And we're crippled with fear that it wouldn't be any good.
We were genuinely surprised that everyone was so nice about it. But it was that thing of almost like, I'm not saying people were expecting it to be shit, but, you know, it was just that guy from Twitter and me who hadn't made a show for a while. Mm-hmm. And like, why would that work? And, you know, the American sort of Irish thing. And we were delighted that people had a very uncynical kind of reaction to it. Mm-hmm. And then because they liked it so much, we were like, oh, people like this.
Yeah.
We really want those people who were so nice about it to continue to like us.
Well, what's interesting, in season one, I think people first tune in because they hear the premise, like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and let's see how these two actors pull that off.
Yeah.
Season two, though, these are more established characters, and you can't necessarily rely on that premise. So how would you compare sort of the direction and the idea for season two versus season one?
Season one was like an appetizer, and this is the main course because it's intense. You know, they're married. They have been for a few years. They have a couple of kids now. The shine is off a little bit, and now it's the real deal. So it's what I'm going through in my life right now and what Sharon has gone through. Her kids are a little older, but she's still in a marriage and still a mom. And that is some fascinating stuff. It's very difficult. It's very funny. And that's, you know, I think was sort of what we most wanted to explore when we started even the first season. We wanted to get to this point and then really dive in.
And so you guys decided relatively fast that you would jump ahead about 2-3 years. And so in the very beginning, we see the birth of...
Don't tell everyone.
It's a little bit of a surprise, but you quickly figure it out in that first episode with the birth of the second baby. And of course, one of the running jokes early on is that only Sharon and her family can pronounce the baby's name.
You say it.
So is it Morin? Morin?
It isn't. That's not what it is.
Okay, so
I'm going to say it, and you have to repeat it. Mirin. No, Mirin.
Mirin.
A bit closer.
Rob, you can do it now, right?
Mirin.
But you see, you had to sort of take a tiny beat before he said it, which is great because in the first episode, we desperately didn't want anyone, you know, pretending they couldn't pronounce it. We wanted everyone to genuinely not be able to pronounce it. And Rob genuinely had a really hard time pronouncing it without that tiny little beat of thought.
Well, let's back up to the beginning. Sharon, you actually kind of put it in a nutshell, what most people knew you back then for, you know, Rob for being a comedian on Twitter and, of course, a number of shows that you did in the UK. Interestingly, from what I understand, Rob, you're the one who had a script deal at the BBC. Is that?
That is correct, yeah.
So how did that work? You were already sort of looking at doing things in the UK?
No, I didn't mean to do that because I lived in LA at the time where plenty of television is made. So I was in LA and my manager said, oh, hey, I got you a deal to write a script at the BBC, which is insane. I wouldn't have even dared to ask for that. You know, I can write a funny scene, I can write a joke, but I can't make excellent television. I've never done that before. So I wanted to ask somebody who I knew could make excellent television, and so that was Sharon. You know, we were already friends at that point. I had reached out to Sharon a couple years previously just because I was a giant fan of hers and her amazing shows. And so I saw that she followed me on Twitter, so I wrote her and said, you know, I'm parked outside your house in a teal Hyundai Sonata. Lift up your blinds and let's be friends. And so that's how that happened. And we both knew we wanted to write something about a relationship, and we knew that it should get to the point where they had kids and were married and were suffering.
Was it always going to be sort of UK specific? Were you familiar with the UK, or was it one of those things where they sort of just said, write whatever you want to write?
They said, write whatever you want to write. We reserve the right to not make it, which is what they did. Mm-hmm. We gave it to the BBC and they said, this is, wow, this is really good. We're not going to make it. And so then we brought it to Channel 4 and they said, sure.
Now talk about Channel 4 real quick, because a lot of our listeners probably have heard of Channel 4 but aren't necessarily familiar with the comic stylings of Channel 4 versus BBC.
A lot of good comedy is made for both of those channels. BBC made The Office and Nighty Night,
Pulling.
Little Britain.
And, yes, and your show, Pulling.
And Pulling. And, I mean, a range of excellent comedy. Channel 4 made Peep Show and...
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. What a good call. Father Ted.
Yeah.
I would say maybe Channel 4 goes for slightly odder stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think our show probably sort of straddles both. But in a way, I think there's a sensibility at Channel 4 that sort of suited our sensibility a bit more. But I mean, with both of those places, you know, like with the BBC and Pulling, they literally gave us no notes and we'd never made anything before. And they were just like, do what you want. And on Channel 4, the only notes we were given were ones that were excellent and appreciated and made the show a better show. So it's lucky, and it doesn't happen very often. We were kind of given carte blanche to just... do what we wanted because they trusted us for some reason.
And when you guys were writing the season one, did you already know that the show had been acquired by Amazon, or did that come later?
We did know.
We brought the pilot to Amazon and we said, guys, what do you think? And they said, this is pretty good. And so they had the pilot and that's it.
I assume you shopped it around, though. How did Amazon sort of win the lotto?
They gave us the biggest kisses.
Yeah, I mean, they...
on our butts.
We didn't know how huge they would become and how quality, you know, for example,
true.
We didn't know what Transparent was or Bosch, you know? Yeah. I mean, we didn't know.
We were so psyched when Transparent came out and we were like, oh my God, we're on that channel.
Yeah, I mean, my God. Now they're a behemoth. It's amazing. So really glad we went with Amazon. Yeah.
The other thing that I think makes the show special is the way you guys do balance the comedy with some serious issues, some serious topics. You know, this year, Sharon, your character is dealing a little bit with postpartum depression. Can you guys talk a little bit about how much you bring sort of these real life issues into the show?
I think neither of us were interested in writing anything that wasn't truthful. And the truth is that life is really hard and it throws loads of shit at you. And you kind of have to struggle to be happy sometimes. And so also it's a challenge to do that and keep it funny. You know, it's kind of harder, but it is more satisfying, you know, because I think the reason why people liked the show was because they were completely invested in those characters. And I think it's it's harder to be really invested in characters if you, you know, if what happens to them doesn't matter.
How far can we go? Season 3, season 4, catastrophe through
take
death.
It, take it to death.
All the way, yeah. Yeah, no, we definitely have ideas for a third that we're cobbling together.
When are we going to hear about it?
Soon.
I'll call you after.
Yeah,
please do. Please do. Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney are the creators and stars of Catastrophe. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.